right, good evening. Continuing our Bible study on Romans, we're going to finish chapter 12 today and we're going to get into chapter 13. I don't know if you recall last week I said chapters 12 and 13 are both short. They're too long to cover an entire chapter in one class, but they're too short to split it into two halves. So I'm, the two chapters I'm covering over 3 weeks. So that's what we're going to do. All right, so last week we started chapter 12, which is a whole new topic, you may remember. The whole concept of Romans is about justification, and Paul has addressed many issues. And now in chapter 12, he started out by saying, okay, what does this mean? Because we are now justified, how do we go forward? How do we live our lives? And so just real brief recap. Right at the beginning of chapter 12, he says, I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. That sets up the next three chapters, almost four chapters. Okay? So he's going to talk about what happens now because you've been justified, not in order to be justified. Okay? And why do we do it? Because of the mercies of God. God's been merciful to us, therefore, how do we respond? And what does he say here? Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Quite a phrase there. Sacrifices are dead. They're killed. So a living sacrifice, that's what we are in our lives. So what we do in our lives is showing thanks to God. And remember, we talked about this for a while, spiritual worship. It's actually reasonable service. Remember that from last week? Reasonable service. This phrase, spiritual worship, is not a particularly good translation there. And then, last week, the next paragraph then, we got into, where's my mouse? There it is. We got into some of the spiritual gifts. He talks about a number of spiritual gifts, and this is not a complete list. There are other spiritual gifts mentioned elsewhere in the New Testament. Also, I would say, maybe a little contrary to that fad of about 20 years ago of doing spiritual gift surveys, I would say, yes, we all have at least one spiritual gift, but it can change. I think all of us either have or have had or will have each of these spiritual gifts when necessary at different times of life. Okay? So these all really apply to all of us at different times in life. And then after that, this is where how far we got last week, then he started talking about our Christian life. And in verse 9 he said, let love be genuine. What a great summary of the rest of this chapter, just a little bit here coming up. Let love be genuine. You can tell when somebody's not sincere, when somebody's not authentic or genuine, right? You can usually tell somebody who's faking it in terms of a relationship with someone else. What does it mean to let love be genuine? You know, I'm not sure I brought this up last week, but from this first word here, abhor what is evil, from that all the way to the end of chapter of verse 13, so all of that in the original Greek is one sentence. It's a long sentence, separated with commas with each of these phrases. So why the translators put all these periods in here, I don't know. But it does help to know that it is one sentence because this is all explaining how love is genuine. Let me zip through this because that's where we finished last week, was at verse 13. So I'll just zip through this fairly quickly and we're going to go on. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Those two thoughts kind of go together. Avoid evil and associate with good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Again, those two thoughts go together. Brotherly affection. The word there is Philadelphos. Yes, the city of brotherly love, which I just saw in the news. Philadelphia, I think, is topping the statistics right now in the country for the most crime. What a way to... The city of brotherly love, and, you know, they're becoming the crime capital of the country, at least at this moment. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Yes. After you. No. After you. No. After you. Do not be slothful in zeal. So if you have a motivation to do something, a zeal for something, then do it. Be energetic about it. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. So again, those three thoughts all go together. fervent in spirit. You know, when you're around somebody who's just a bubbly spirit, it is such an uplifting thing. You just want to have lunch, you know. You just want to be with that type of attitude. It's good for us to try and strive to have that attitude more regularly in our own lives, too. And there may be times where you're bubbly and you don't even know it. Okay? All right, I know it's a little hard for us German Lutherans to be bubbly in spirit, right? We tend to be more serious. Yeah. Norwegians, too. Rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. These thoughts go together as well. We have hope, unlike the rest of the world. We have hope because we know the future. We don't necessarily know the immediate future, what's going to happen in our lives and the struggles we have, but we know the more distant future. We know that God has saved us and forgiven us and has a place for us. So we can rejoice in that hope. And because of that hope, we can be patient in tribulation. We all have tribulation. Be patient. Persevere through it. And how do you do that? By being constant in prayer. What great practical advice right here in life, right? Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. Again, those two thoughts go together. So, any lingering questions or thoughts from last week and this first paragraph here? And then he's going to continue this thought. We're going to go on. But any thoughts or questions first? All right, continuing on, verse 14. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Wow. Well, that's kind of a hard thing to do, isn't it? I don't know that anybody really does that naturally. Somebody's persecuting you. I would have this image in my mind: a bully on the playground, picking on somebody smaller or younger or weaker, and the person being picked on compliments or blesses in some way or thanks the bully for something they did at some other point in time, or bless those who persecute you. That's hard to do. And yet what Paul is reflecting here is what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount. You remember what he taught about do not hate your brother, but forgive him, love your brother. All of that stuff that he talked about. Bless and do not curse them. And then verse 15, rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. So this is showing having harmony with one another. Again, he's reflecting what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount. So when we have a fellow member in the church who's rejoicing about something, we should join them in celebrating. Sometimes our human tendency is to be jealous. Oh, somebody just got a fancy new car, or somebody got a new job with a big raise or something like that. You know, or whatever it might be that they're rejoicing in. We should join them in celebrating and make sure we strive to tamp down any jealousy that might take place. Weep with those who weep. Again, I'm kind of proud of our congregation. We do that. When somebody's struggling or having trouble or sorrow, we give them a lot of comfort. My impression is, anyway. We console those who are grieving. Okay? So, we should do that. What does this show? Rejoice with those who are rejoicing and weep with those who are weeping. It's showing harmony. That's verse 16. Live in harmony with one another. Now, I looked up the word harmony. And what it means is to have the same thoughts. That's what the Greek word means very literally. Have the same thoughts with one another. That's what to be in harmony is. Let's see. Everybody in here is married or has been married. How easy is it to have the same thoughts as your spouse? Even if you don't have your spouse anymore, you still know the situation in marriage, right? There are lots of times that my wife and I do not have the same thoughts. I think one thing, no, we should do this. She thinks another thing, no, we should do that. No, I think we need to turn left. No, we need to turn right. Whatever it is. Live in harmony with one another. Have the same thoughts as one another. And that's part of what we do as the family of Christ, too. It's difficult at times. Because in our natural human state, we think about ourselves. Well, how do you live in harmony with one another? So again, Paul is getting very practical in this section of his letter. Live in harmony with one another. How do you do that? Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. What does haughty mean? That's a strange word. I don't think we use that word in the common English.
Better than thou. Better than thou.
Yeah, better than someone else. Right?
Arrogant.
Proud, arrogant. Yep. Do not be haughty. Right. Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought. Remember that from last week? Paul mentioned that earlier in the chapter. This is the second time it's come up. Maybe there's something to that. When we think of ourselves as more important than we really are, or as proud of ourselves more than we should be, it starts to cause disharmony. Okay? So, you want to be in harmony with one another? Don't be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Lowly, what would lowly mean? What might that word mean? Do any of you remember that was an old-fashioned cartoon-style animals in children's books? And there was a worm that was named Lowly. Lowly the worm. No? Nobody remembers that? That was the era that I grew up. Those books kind of went out of print or out of vogue. They're not, they weren't common anymore. Okay, all right, never mind. Nobody remembers that except me. Yeah, there was a worm named Lowly. What does it mean to be lowly?
Somebody who doesn't have as much as you do.
Okay, sure. Somebody with less resources. Somebody with less. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean somebody who's poor, although it could be. It doesn't mean somebody who has less abilities, although it could be. I would really say it's somebody who is not haughty. Somebody who understands the reality of their own situation. Right? And what they can do and what they can't do. You want to associate with such people. And continuing that thought, Paul then says, never be wise in your own sight. Have you ever been around someone who was wise in their own sight?
I'm so humble it makes me proud.
Yeah, there you go. There was a guy I knew once, not real well, just an acquaintance. And boy, he sure acted like he was the expert on any topic that came up in conversation. You know such people, right? Usually when you are around such people, what do you want to do? Yeah, go somewhere else. Yeah, and unfortunately, like in this case, this guy I knew, he wasn't a member of our church, wasn't a Lutheran actually, it was just an acquaintance from playing racquetball. And so he'd come and, you know, in between games, and we'd be talking about this or that on the news, and boy, he would tell us this is the way it should be, and that's the way it wasn't, and that's what that means in the news, and I'm like, yeah, all of us, we're all looking at him like, so you're the expert on absolutely everything, are you? That's how he acted. Do not be wise in your own sight. And then he continues on, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. Ooh, this is interesting here. Repay no one evil for evil. So again, that reflects Jesus' teachings. What does Jesus say about the cheek? Turn the other cheek, right? Do not repay evil for evil. And by the way, this right here is starting to set up chapter 13. Do not repay evil for evil. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. Right? We're not the ones who bring about justice on people who have wronged us, who have committed evil against us. That's not our job, to repay them evil, to bring them to justice. But boy, sometimes we just want to. Oh, that person, you know what he did to me, so I'm going to get them back. I want to get them back. I want to start a rumor about them, or I want to, you know, reveal some secret of theirs, or, you know, whatever it might be. You just want to get them back. Well, that's not our job. God will take care of it. God will bring justice. You may or may not see it. but he will bring justice. Okay, so repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. This is interesting. Consider what different people think is honorable before you act. And I have an example. I was thinking about an illustration for this, because as I was studying this, it kind of, I came to realize, reading the commentary and also looking at this, this means you have a situation, you have a conundrum in life. Well, is it more honorable to do this, or is it more honorable to do that? Well, what do those people think? Do those people think this is honorable or that? Do those people think this is honorable or that? What does God think? Is this honorable or that? Take into consideration what is honorable according to other people, especially according to God. Here's the illustration I came up with, because I've mentioned this before, especially to young couples who are getting married. There's a young couple who's dating. Maybe they're semi-serious, and then a pregnancy happens. You all know this situation. I have extended relatives where this happened. And what might be considered honorable by some people in our society is to have an abortion. After all, you don't want to ruin your lives. You're not married yet. And, you know, there's a lot of requirements and responsibility from a baby. So just have an abortion. It's no big deal. What might be honorable to some other people would be get married, raise the baby. What might be honorable to other people might be give the baby up for adoption to a family that can't have children and would like one. So what do you do? For us as Christians, you consider, well, who thinks abortion is honorable? Nobody I respect. Not God either. You know, God is pro-life. So that's not a good option. That's a dishonorable option in the eyes of God and the church. So that one's out of the way. But what about the other two options? What about getting married and raising the child? Well, I know some cases where pregnancy happened before marriage, so the couple decided to get married and raise the baby, but they really hadn't been dating long enough to know each other well enough. And what ends up happening is a divorce. So if they get married and raise the baby and the marriage works and they stay together, yeah, that's a great option. But what if there's a possibility of a divorce there? Maybe giving up the baby for adoption is a more honorable option. Possibly. But then, you know, if you ask me in my situation, I would just be crushed by not being able to see my child. And I'm the man, the husband, the father, not the wife. It's even more for the wife, the mother. So what is the best option? Well, I don't know. We can clearly rule out one option. The other two options are both honorable. What is the most honorable in the sight of God? I don't have an answer other than to say, when we're stuck with some rather serious conundrums in life, consider what is honorable and who would be the one that would encourage certain options. Because if somebody who is not a Christian, not a believer, is advising a certain direction, that's maybe not the most honorable option just by where the advice is coming from. Does it make sense?
Right, it goes on with verse 12, where it says, be constant in prayer. So to me, when you're in those situations, that's one thing you want to do is be praying a lot about it.
Yes, absolutely be praying a lot about it. You bet. And I talk to young couples. I say, you know, if you can't have children, what would you do? And, you know, a lot of them will say, well, we'd adopt. And I say, that's a great option. That's a wonderful option. It's an honorable option. You bet. Okay. So, give thought to what is honorable in the sight of all. Any other thoughts or comments? Okay, going on, verse 18. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Now, this is another piece of practical advice. You get in a dispute with somebody, an argument, say, and you can kind of settle it in your mind, and on your side, you apologize, and in your mind, you forgive the other person, even though maybe they didn't even apologize verbally, and the other person is still mad. They hold a grudge. What can you do about that situation? Continue to live peaceably. You just continue to live politely, peaceably, cooperatively with the other person, and hopefully over time their grudge will diminish and they will come to a point where they will apologize for their own part and express forgiveness for your part. But if you have already in your mind buried the hatchet, then there's not much more you can do on their side other than pray for them. By holding a grudge, by not forgiving somebody, by not apologizing for your own part and not forgiving the other person, who do you really harm? You harm yourself, not the other person. Okay? So, live peaceably with all. I've got two quick thoughts on this, very short side illustrations. First of all, bury the hatchet. You should bury the hatchet with everybody. Did you ever think about where that phrase came from? I did. I looked it up. That is a uniquely American phrase. Did you know that? You know where it comes from? Delmar, you might know, or you could have a good guess.
From our Native Americans.
Yep. The Native Americans, one of their primary weapons was a hatchet. And so if this tribe was at war with that tribe, and they were fighting, and their warriors were fighting with their warriors, and if they came to terms of peace, they would literally take a hatchet and bury it in the ground and leave it there to say, we've buried the hatchet. This tribe's at peace with that tribe. So yes, it's a Native American phrase that got worked into American English language, you know, a phrase. Bury the hatchet. You should bury the hatchet. You should live peaceably with all, even if the other person is still holding a grudge or being unforgiving. And continue to live peaceably with them. The second quick thought I have on this is a Lord of the Rings reference. On Wednesday morning, Bob Wolfinger sits right here, so he'll get this reference. Are any of you Lord of the Rings fans? I don't know that any of you are as much a Lord of the Rings geek as I am. A part in there where Frodo, who's one of the key characters, he is assaulted or attacked by one of his companions, who then later apologizes to him or repents of it, and then after that point is killed in battle. That other guy, it's Boromir is his name, his dad later asks Frodo, well, were you friends with Boromir? And Frodo says, yes, for my part. In other words, I was at peace with him even though he attacked me trying to take the ring, was what was happening. So Frodo forgave Boromir and was at peace. Okay? He says, for my part. That's a common quote from the movie. So live peaceably with all. Sometimes that's hard to do, isn't it? Oh, we like to hold our grudges. We want to get revenge, and we think we're going to get the other person back, but by holding your grudge, you're really only hurting yourself. And then here we go, we're going on, starting with this repay no one evil for evil, and now he's continuing on at verse 19. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. If you knew 100% certain, and see, here's part of the problem, we have doubts. If you knew 100% certain, and it is, that God would avenge you. Every wrong someone has committed against you, God will take care of it. He'll clear it up, he'll bring about justice, he'll do what is right in that situation, to correct the situation. 100%. Could you then let go of that wrong that's been committed against you and just go on and live your life peaceably? Ideally, yes. Problem is we don't forget that. Or we don't forget the wrong. against us, or we don't fully, completely trust that God will bring about justice. Okay, there's two problems with it. But ideally, turn it over to God. I was wronged in this way or that way by my neighbor, by the government, by the culture, whatever. God will make it right. You may or may not see it.
There was a lady I used to work with, and she kind of had that attitude, because I remember times when people would say something about something that happened to her, she'd always just go, I just let God fight my battles.
That's a great attitude. Yeah. Very good. Let God fight your battles. And that's hard to do sometimes.
Well, I was always impressed that she'd always say that if something, you know, we should do this, you should do that. She'd always go, I just let God fight my battles.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, Delmer?
Two things. One thing is our society in particular does not believe in delayed gratification. If God's going to do that, I want it done
now.
Yesterday.
Yeah, exactly right. If God's going to bring about justice for me, I want it done right now so I can see it. Yeah, you're right. That's true.
And the other thing is there's a Chinese saying that says holding a grudge is like taking poison and expecting the other person to die.
I think you brought that up a week or two ago in this class, or somebody did. No? Maybe it was on Wednesday. But yes, that's absolutely true. That's a good insight as well. Holding a grudge is really just poisoning yourself. Yeah. Very true. Leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Verse 20, to the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Wow, imagine trying to teach that to the military, right? If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. Man, if somebody is attacking you or fighting against you, I mean literally, physically, like in a war, and you're supposed to feed and give drinks to the enemy while they're attacking you? Not quite. That is kind of the intent here. I have this vision in my head, and I can't cite a specific movie, but I'm also a war movie buff. I've seen almost every war movie that's out there, and I like them all. Just, I don't know why I'm fascinated with it. And, you know, some of like the World War II movies. And you would see that after a battle is over, and maybe it's a specific battle, and in many cases the Americans won, or the Allies won against the Axis in a given battle, and so they have a whole bunch of prisoners, Germans or Italians or whatever, and what are our soldiers doing for the other soldiers after they've stopped them from battling, after they've won the battle and they've stopped the battle? They start to give them food or water or medical attention to the enemy. I think that's a little bit of this. If your enemy is attacking you, you have a right, we would say as our church, you have a right to defend yourself. It's the just war theory. That's not what's in view here. I'm going off track a little bit. Our church, along with the Catholic Church, actually, the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church are very united on this doctrine of just war. Just war. It is okay. It is morally upstanding. It is acceptable to God to go to war to defend yourself. That's a just war. And if you think about it, I believe every war that the United States has ever been in has been to defend us or an ally. Okay? We've never attacked another country like Russia did Ukraine. They attacked, right? Ukraine is defending themselves. So that's a just war. So if somebody's attacking you, if an enemy is attacking you, you have a right to defend yourself and stop them from attacking. But once you've stopped them, or disarmed them, or prevented them from going further, now you help take care of your enemy. I remember also seeing Civil War movies. And this happened in the Civil War, even though there were some soldiers in the North and some in the South that absolutely hated each other, yet they're of both of the American culture, same language, you know, all of that. And yet after a battle was over, they would share rations, especially the North with the South, because the South was much poorer. And so they would give them food because these soldiers were starving. And so they would help one another after the battle, after they had stopped the enemy from advancing or continuing. I've never been a soldier. I wonder how difficult that would be. Any of you here been in the military? Okay, a few of you. Can you imagine being in a war and stopping your enemy and then helping him? I think that happens. That is a godly thing to do. I think that'd be very hard. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. What does that mean, burning coals on his head?
I read that back at the time of this verse, that if you were in an encampment and you didn't keep your fire going, and it went out in the night, they didn't have matches, so you would go tent to tent and ask, hey, do you have an extra coal? My coals have gone out, in order to get some coals to restart your own fire.
Okay.
And to carry them, they had a deal on their, a special hat or a special container that they would carry on their head.
Huh.
So to go from place to place, and so if your enemy, some guy that you didn't like, came, well, sure, you just load him up. So everybody knew, hey, he's been to my tent, and I gave him as many coals as he could carry.
Hmm. I had not heard that before. Well, that's interesting. Thank you, Delmar. I think that fits with the idea here. By heaping burning coals on someone's head, it's basically you're shaming them. You're showing them up. You're saying, I'm acting appropriately. You're acting poorly. So it's kind of pointing out some shame to them for the purpose of trying to get them to turn their ways, to change their ways. Okay? Rich?
Yeah, I never read this anywhere, but I always took this as back to where God is going to have vengeance. God's going to take care of this problem. But on the other hand, sometimes an enemy is antagonizing you, and you're getting enjoyment out of your misery or their control over you. And if you're nice to them, they become angry or a hothead, and they're even madder at the fact that they can't control you.
Well, I agree you're right. You can extend this. You know, out in life, in the schoolyard, in the workplace, somebody might be trying to manipulate you, control you, as you say, Rich. And if you're acting nice to them in return, you're either going to shame them, heaping burning coals on their head, you're going to shame them so that they change their ways and realize they're being manipulative, mean, mean-spirited towards you, or you're going to make them even more angry, in which case God will bring down vengeance upon them. That sound right? Mm-hmm. I'm taking what you said, Rich, and extending it a little bit. I think you're right. So, be nice to other people. And it will either shame them into changing their ways, or it'll make them mad, in which case they're bringing down even more of God's vengeance upon themselves. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That relates right here to this previous verse, 20. 20 and 21 are kind of in sync, aren't they?
That's a quote from Proverbs 21 and 22.
Yeah, you're right. That is a quote from Proverbs. Yep. Exactly. Now, how does God bring vengeance upon those who have wronged us? You've been wronged in life, maybe in culture, maybe in society, maybe in the workplace. You've been wronged. How does God bring about vengeance for you? That's the next question. Guess what the beginning of chapter 13 is about? This whole book is very linear in logical thought. So we're going to go on now, unless you have some questions. Any final questions or thoughts? We're going to go on now and do the first paragraph of chapter 13, which is Paul explaining how God has vengeance or brings about justice on your behalf. So those of you who are looking ahead in your Bibles, you'll see it. Ah, there we go. chapter 13, verse 1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Oh, this whole next paragraph, yeah, it's kind of a long paragraph, but we're going to get through this paragraph. It's like 7 verses. This whole paragraph is about what? Government. Does God institute government in order to maintain peace? Yes. Does God institute government in order to create order? Yes. Is peace and order good for God's children, for Christians? Yes. Does God also institute order to avenge you when you have been wronged? Yes. Martin Luther wrote a pamphlet at his time because there were some soldiers and law enforcement people who were bothered in their consciences by going to war against someone else or by inflicting justice upon a criminal. And he said, actually what you're doing is godly because you are working to maintain order in society. And so it is a good and godly vocation to be part of the government for the purpose of maintaining justice in society. And it comes from God. Paul says that right here. So there may be certain policies we don't like in our government right now. There may be certain politicians we don't like in our government right now. But we still have to respect them and submit to them. While we can, within the prescribed methods, try to change our government for the better. And in our particular situation, that means vote appropriately, right? So, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Now it says be subject to. I gotta point this out. The word there is not, and this is true in the Greek too, it is not obey. It's subject to. What is the difference between being subject to and obeying? I've got a quote for you. This is from Dr. Middendorf himself, the author of this commentary. He says, Paul views all people as subjects to them all and therefore commands his hearers to be subject to, or perhaps to submit themselves to, these authorities without adding qualification. However, the verb subject to is not one of the verbs typically translated as obey. Therefore, be subject to need not always include responding in complete conformity with what is heard. Neither does it demand total obedience in every instance. Even if noncompliance or direct disobedience to a human authority becomes necessary for a believer, it is to be accompanied by the recognition that one still remains subject to the temporal power, the power of authorities, whose response may well involve punishment. You remember what Peter says in Acts? We must obey God rather than men. So as far as we can, as much as we can, we obey earthly authorities because God has established them for our benefit. But when earthly authorities go against God's will, then we disobey earthly authorities, knowing that we are going to bring down the ire and the wrath of those earthly authorities. Maybe wrongly so. Maybe they're corrupt authorities. But we're still going to bring down their wrath against us. Now, if an earthly authority is bad or corrupt, who corrects the earthly authority? Other earthly authorities at the direction of God. You remember what God did to the earthly authorities of the northern and southern kingdom when they became corrupt? The kings of Israel and the kings of Judah became corrupt one after another and unfaithful and non-believing. And so how did God correct or bring justice upon those earthly authorities? The Babylonians. He brought the Babylonians in, wiped them out, and took them all into exile. However, the Babylonians themselves, with a few slight exceptions, the Babylonians themselves were corrupt and an evil people. So how did God discipline them or bring justice upon them? The Persians. The Persians conquered the Babylonians and released the Jews to go back to their homeland. Do you see how God uses earthly authorities against one another? Does he do that in our society too? Yeah, he does. So, we must be subject to governing authorities, although that doesn't necessarily mean complete obedience. If I had somebody, some governmental authority, tell me that I had to preach in favor of abortion or gay marriage, I would absolutely disobey, recognizing the possibility that I could get arrested or fined or, you know, a citation or something like that. And I would still accept that punishment while continuing to disobey. You know? That's what Dr. Middendorf said in that quote that I just read. Okay? Does that make sense? All right. Verse 2. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. This, right here, these couple of verses, and especially that verse 2, caused quite some crisis of conscience for Lutherans at the time of the American Revolution. Think about history. Why did the American colonies revolt against the King of England? What have we been taught? What was the reason or the cause?
Taxes.
Taxation without representation, right? There were probably some other secondary causes, but that was a big one. He was imposing, the King of England, King George, was imposing all these taxes on tea, right? The Boston Tea Party. Everybody kind of remember all of that? Well, is there anything in the Bible about paying taxes or not paying taxes? Yep. We're coming up to one of them. There's others like this too. Should we pay taxes? Yeah. Government is there to protect us. Now, we might not like the level of taxation. We might not like what the taxes are being used for. And we can voice our opinion or work to change that within the authority, but we still have to pay taxes. So Lutherans, at the time of the American Revolution, and there were some, the Missouri Synod had not yet been established, but there were Lutherans in America in the American colonies. Okay? And they were split. Some of them said, we need to be subject to King George in order to be God-pleasing. Even though we don't like his taxes, we think he's taxing us too much for his own benefit, we still need to be subject to him. And so they taught and strived to remain loyalists to the King of England. The other half of the Lutherans at the time said that, no, he's taxing us for his own immoral purposes, his own corrupt purposes, so we need to fight against that. So they joined the rebellion, the revolution. So there was quite a conundrum, a crisis of conscience between Lutherans at the time of the revolution. And I can understand that. I don't know which side I would have fallen on. I imagine I would have fallen on the revolutionary side because of the improprieties of King George. But I don't know. I mean, this, you can kind of see the conundrum right here, right? Be subject to the governing authorities? And it, was King George doing anything against the Bible? No. He was overtaxing. Yeah? But it's not against the Bible. So what do you do? Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. Ow. Wow. So I can't protest against our government when they have some policy I don't like? Protest, I would say this, in our culture, in American culture, peaceful protests are allowable. So you're not actually resisting the government by participating in a peaceful protest. Now there are violent protests. We saw a whole bunch of those just recently, right, in the news. Those I think God would condemn. And I wish more of our media would have condemned them as well. But so violent protests, I would say, are not allowed within our culture, or shouldn't be, but peaceful protests would be within that bounds. Verse 3, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. See, right there, how does God bring about justice upon those who wrong you in life? through the governing authorities. Now, if the governing authorities is an upstanding, good, honest authority, governing authority, you can trust them. And so then you would need to obey those policies that they establish. Do what is good, you will receive his approval, and avoid doing what is wrong, because then you shall be punished. Right here, by the way, embedded in these, I'll point it out to you, are the two purposes of government, according to God. Two purposes of government. To approve and promote what is good, and to punish evil. Bear the sword in vain, he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Those are the two God-given purposes of government. Promote the good, punish the bad. Okay? No, that sounds appropriate, right? By the way, this came up in the commentary that I was reading. This says nothing about social programs. If some of you know the word adiaphora, it kind of gets bandied about sometimes in our Lutheran circles. Adiaphora is a fancy Latin word that means neither commanded nor forbidden. Okay? So, for instance, having acolytes in church, it's neither commanded nor forbidden. Do you have to have an acolyte in church to light candles? No. Can you if you want to? Yes. Having your government perform social programs, welfare, Medicaid, you know, other social programs that our government is involved a lot in, that is neither commanded nor forbidden. If our government did not perform any of those social programs, it could still uphold the God-given purpose of government. In fact, I would say we might be better off. Maybe not. I mean, there's an argument to be made both ways. What it was at the time of Paul, he was teaching and promoting that the government keeps the peace and order, promotes the good and punishes the wrongdoer. And it was the job of the church to take care of all those social programs, to care for the poor, to help those who were sick. And the early Christians became known for that. Because non-Christians didn't care. Oh, those are just poor people, they don't have money, or those are sick people, I don't want to help them anyway. Christians became known to have compassion for people because they helped the poor and they helped and tended to the sick. I think that's how it was early on in American government. It wasn't until the 20th century that the American government started getting into social programs. Now, if some of you want to alter my view of history, you can. We can talk about it a little bit. This is my impression. So in the 20th century, the American government started getting into all these social programs. And on the one hand, maybe that's not so bad, because that means the government has a wider reach than the church has. The church can only affect this many people. The government can affect more people, can impact or help more people. However, a downside to that was the church retreated from helping those who it should help. Right? That's my view. Sometime from the mid-20th century to the late 20th century, churches, Lutheran and otherwise, became less concerned with helping the downtrodden. Because the government was doing it. So it's a good news, bad news situation. God doesn't command the government to do it, but he doesn't forbid the government from doing it. Okay, now I've been standing on a soapbox for about 5 minutes. Any questions or comments?
Well, could I get hospitals? A lot of the old hospitals were all like...
Yes! All the old hospitals from the early 20th century were founded by Christian groups. Right. You know, the Methodist hospital, the Baptist hospital, the Lutheran hospital. Yes, they were all Christian-based, because that's where they came from, and then they got taken over. Yeah, exactly right. Any other thoughts or comments? Okay, Delmar.
At the beginning of this, where it says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, probably the best example we have is Jesus.
Yeah, right.
We're coming up on that.
We are coming up on that. Was Jesus subject to the governing authorities? Yes. Was it a corrupt governing authority? Yes. And he still submitted to it, didn't he? And God ultimately brought about justice by raising Jesus from the dead. For our benefit, by the way. Yeah, that's a great example. You're absolutely right. Jesus is a prime example of this. Right. All right, let's finish these last couple of verses here. Let's see, where was I? Verse 5. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. So there he's reflecting or reiterating what he had said before, that God is the one who's established authorities. So if you don't want to be in fear of punishment from the government or in punishment from God, you need to be subject to the governing authorities. And also for the sake of conscience. Do you want to live without fear of the authority? Do you want to live without fear of God's reprimands? Then for the sake of your own conscience, be subject to the governing authorities. So what Paul is talking about in this paragraph is being subject, not obedient necessarily. It may or may not be obedience, but be subject to the governing authorities for those two reasons. So that need not fear recriminations, and you can live at peace. All right, verse 6. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. See, this right here, especially because it has this word ministers, this is one key spot where we as Lutherans develop the concept of two kingdoms. Okay, there's other spots as well. But you guys all have heard of the Lutheran teaching of two kingdoms, right? Left-hand kingdom, right-hand kingdom. Right-hand kingdom is the church. The church's business is to promote and teach about God, to distribute forgiveness of sins, to strengthen in faith spiritual matters, not earthly matters. The Lutheran church has always taught that the church should stay out of earthly political affairs, except where the Bible is clear. And there's three spots where I would say we as the church get involved in culture or politics. One is religious freedom. We want to maintain the freedom to say and do and meet together as we please without government interference. Another one is abortion, which is clear in the Bible. God is a God of life. Life begins at conception. And the third one is the definition of marriage. One man and one woman. So those three areas, which some would say are cultural political issues, we would say, no, they're actually more than cultural political issues. They are theological issues. So those three issues the church will speak on. Our church. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, do you want more taxes or less? Are you a capitalist or a socialist? Do you think we should have more social programs or less social programs? Do you think we should change the immigration laws to allow in more or less immigrants? Do you think we should be involved in wars overseas? All those types of political issues, our church is silent. Those are political issues. Okay? Now I have my own personal opinion on all those matters, but I keep them to myself or private. By the way, I prefer less taxes. There, I guess it's not quite so private, is it? So they're ministers of God. So the right-hand kingdom is the church, which is involved in spiritual matters, eternal matters. The left-hand kingdom is the government, which is primary, their purpose is to maintain peace and order for the goodwill of society. That's their job. We would also resist the idea that government can have any say in churchly matters. We would say absolutely not. The government needs to stay out. So when Thomas Jefferson wrote about the wall of separation between church and state, Lutherans were right there with that idea. That was an idea that actually Martin Luther had developed even before Thomas Jefferson voiced that opinion during the American Revolution. Okay? Luther had already developed that idea. Separation of church and state, two kingdoms, right-hand kingdom, left-hand kingdom, and they should not cross except in those few limited issues. Okay? All right, any thoughts or comments about that?
Isn't that kind of contrary to the way it was, because the Pope was kind of
yes.
Very political?
Yes, the Pope was and still is very political, And the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor at the time of Luther, was very involved in church stuff, too. So they went both ways. The Pope tried to influence secular government, and the Holy Roman Emperor at the time of Martin Luther was deeply involved in church politics, and it was going both ways, and it was becoming a mess. So Luther read this, Romans chapter 13, along with a couple of other spots, so I could, you know, research and point out a few other spots that kind of reflect this same idea. And he said, you two need to stay out of each other's business. The Pope should just be involved in churchly business, and the Emperor should just be involved in government business, and stop trying to meddle in each other's business. Yes, that there was a lot of that throughout the Middle Ages. And Luther said, that's wrong. Or it's not ideal, or it's not the way God intended. However you might want to say that. Yeah, you're right. Okay. So authorities are ministers of God. Ministers in the left-hand kingdom. Attending to the very thing. So, pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed. Honor to whom honor is owed. Now, in the commentary, he points out that all of this is really related to various governmental entities. So certain authorities you owe taxes to. The federal government in the U.S. and the state government. Certain authorities you owe revenue to. You might owe revenue like in the form of sales tax. That's a portion of revenue. You know, your spending, what you're spending. You pay a percentage. In Michigan, it's 6%, right? It's still 6%, isn't it? Yeah. Respect to whom respect is owed. I don't pay directly for the local policeman, but I respect him, even when he's writing me a speeding ticket. That has happened, by the way. I don't know about you, policemen, writing me tickets. Honor to whom honor is owed. You should honor the judge, right? You go before in a court. You're not paying him tax or revenue. But for a judge, you're paying him respect and honor. So this is really, this verse about paying taxes, revenue, respect, and honor is really in reference to different levels of authority. But I personally would extend this to everybody. If you owe your fellow neighbor honor or respect, you should honor and respect them. If you owe revenue to a landlord, you should pay your revenue. Don't go back on your promise. You're renting an apartment or you're renting an office building for a business. You signed a contract. You agreed to pay revenue. You need to pay that revenue. So we need to hold up our end of the bargain. So I would extend this last verse 7 to many different areas of life, not just to the governing authorities. Okay, but that is how Paul means it here, is giving to the various levels of governing authorities. Okay, there we go. Just over an hour. I think I got everything on my notes. Oh, there's one thing I missed. Let me go back. Page 1300 in here. Let's see. Here we go. This is referenced to, this is from Martin Franzmann, who is one of our Lutheran seminary professors from the mid-20th century. And this brief quote I'm going to mention to you is regarding chapter 13, verse 1. He says, one could reproduce the feature of Paul's Greek in bad English somewhat as follows. Be subordinated to the authorities that existed that have been ordained by God. He who refuses to subordinate himself is resisting God's ordinance. Therefore, one must subordinate oneself. The reason he's giving us a translation in bad English is because in these first two verses, the words are all ordained. God ordained. See, I didn't point that out. I should have when we were up here in these first two verses. The authority resists what God has appointed. That word appointed is ordained. A pastor is ordained. God has ordained governing authorities. And so the word here for subject is actually subordained. Subordinated, we would say in English, but subordained. So you should be subordained to the governing authorities which God has ordained. And we don't talk that way in English. It's very clunky English. That's why Martin Fransman says, you know, if you want to get the true sense of these two verses, think about it that way. Okay. All right. Otherwise, I think I got everything on my notes. Any questions or comments?
You were just talking about that. It reminds me of when Jesus was before Pilate. He told Pilate, you'd have no authority over me if it hasn't been from given you from above.
Yes.
So excellent
observation as well. You guys have brought up some good observations tonight. You're right. There's another example of Jesus saying, I will be subject to you, Pilate, but you've been given your authority by God above. So, yeah, exactly. Fits in hand in glove with what Paul's talking about here. Very good. Other thoughts, comments, observations? Yeah.
Back to World War II.
Yeah.
I think what all I was talking about, what you talked about, is you defeated your enemy, and now you're not going to take revenge on them.
Yes.
And for our nation, I think the biggest example of that, or the best known one, is the Marshall Plan.
Okay.
We had,
helping rebuild our enemy nations after we've defeated them. That was a godly thing to do. And it cost us a lot of money, didn't it? Yeah, you're right. You're right. Once you've defeated your enemy, you don't take revenge on him, but instead help him. And I think generally Americans have done that. I'm sure there are instances where, again, in all the war movies I've seen, sometimes they show bad occurrences where a soldier defeats the other soldier and then takes revenge on him. But it's not what God would intend. Right. All right, anything else? All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Remember, no Bible study next week. Come back in 2 weeks.